Zazen manual. Bodhisattvas aspiring to prajna wisdom should first arouse great compassion. Take the four great vows and cultivate samadhi concentration. Vowing to set all beings free, do not seek liberation for yourself alone. Then let go of all conditions and put all concerns to rest, with body and mind one, and no separation between movement and stillness. Be moderate with food and drink, taking neither too much nor too little. Regulate sleep, neither depriving nor indulging. For Zazen, spread a thick mat in a quiet place. Loosen your clothing, but maintain proper bearing, and sit in full lotus. First, place right foot on left thigh, then left foot on right thigh, or sit in half lotus, placing left foot on right thigh. Next, place right hand on left foot, left hand on right palm, thumbs touching. Raise torso and stretch it forward, rock side to side, then sit erect. Do not tilt to one side, forward or backward. Align hips, spine, and head like a stupa. But do not strain to make your body erect, as this will constrict breath and cause discomfort. Ears in line with shoulders, nose in line with navel, tongue resting on upper palate, mouth gently closed, eyes slightly open to prevent drowsiness. This is best for sustaining the concentrated power of dhyana. In former times, eminent monks adept in this practice always sat with eyes open. Zen master Fayun scolded those sitting with eyes closed, like a ghost cave in a dark mountain. There is good reason for this, which adepts know well. With body settled, regulate breath and relax abdomen. Do not give rise to any thoughts, good or bad. If a thought does arise, be aware of it. Once you're aware of it, it disappears. Eventually, conditions are forgotten and all is naturally unified. This is the essence of Zazen. Zazen really is the Dharma gate of ease and joy. If people become ill from it, they are not doing it with proper care. Done properly, your whole body naturally becomes light and at ease. Spirit fresh, mind clear. The flavor of Dharma sustains, and you are calm, pure, and joyful. If you've already had a realization, it is like a dragon entering water or a tiger roaming mountains. If you have yet to realize it, use the wind to fan the flame. Great effort is not needed. Just confirm it yourself and you will not be deceived. Where the path is lofty, however, demons abound and there are all sorts of experiences, agreeable and disagreeable. Just maintain mindfulness and none of this can obstruct you. The Surangama Sutra, Tian Tai Chi Guang, and Guifeng's Manual for Cultivation and Realization describe in detail these demonic states, so you can be prepared in advance. Coming out of meditation, move slowly and rise calmly without haste or roughness. Then at all times use appropriate means to protect and sustain the concentrated power of dhyana, as if caring for a babe in arms. Thus it develops easily. This is the most urgent task. If you don't practice calmly and quietly, in the end you'll be completely lost. To search for the pearl, it's best to calm the waves. With the water of concentration still and clear, the mind pearl reveals itself. Thus, the Perfect Enlightenment Sutra says that unhindered and pure wisdom arises from dhyana. The Lotus Sutra says that in a quiet place, one should cultivate the mind and let it settle so that it is as still as Mount Sumeru. Thus, to transcend secular and sacred, quiet meditation is necessary. To freely pass away sitting or standing is dependent on the concentrated power of dhyana. Even if you devote your life to it, be wary of falling short. And if you waste your time, how in the world will you overcome your karmic hindrances? Thus, an ancient has said that without the concentrated power of dhyana, you will cower at death's door. With eyes covered, you end your life in vain, like a vagabond. Fortunate Dharma friends, please read this manual again and again for the benefit of oneself as well as others. Let us all together fully awaken. That is the Zazen manual. Does anyone have a question or concern about the content of the Zazen manual? Yes.
Yes, James. There's one phrase in there that I wanted to figure out what to do with. That's regulate
breath. It's interesting because that's the only place where it's really mentioned, although nowadays in Japanese Zen, especially in certain schools of Rinzai Zen, there's a real obsession with breathing from the hara. They really turn it into everything. But here it's very clear. So it's one character mentioned once in the whole thing. But it's easy to misunderstand the breath. Regulate the breath, similar to regulate the sleep. Huh? But here, very simply, what it means is perhaps 1,100 years ago, there was a similar problem. In our busy daily lives, we tend to breathe in a very shallow way. And the breath affects our mind state. It's clear now from scientific experiments. By altering our breath, we can actually alter our heartbeat. It's a simple physiological fact. So rather than this kind of very shallow breath, we take the breath in a sense as the object of meditation. And then we, to be dramatic, cement ourselves, our awareness, to the breath. And to regulate it means, over time, with the focus, that breath becomes slower and deeper and longer. There are different ways to do it, focusing on the tip of the nose, focusing on the top of the lip. In the Zen tradition, they tend to focus here instead, below, a little bit below the belly, the hara, the tanden. There are different terms for it. It's the physical center of the body. It makes perfect sense. Not the head, but the physical center of the body. You're not breathing from here, you're breathing from your lungs. But by using the muscles of the diaphragm here, you, over time, when they say regulate, that doesn't mean to force it, as often happens with this Rinzai Zen emphasis on it. They become these breathing machines, and they get headaches and stomach aches. I often have people come to the Hermitage broken from this kind of forceful practice in other places that they do it. So to regulate the breath, we are first mindful of it. Often we're not. We are mindful of the breath, and we do not separate from the breath. Often the expression is used to follow your breath. No, you don't follow it. You're still separate from it. You are one with the breath, or you don't separate from the breath. That's regulating the breath. Okay. Yeah.
Pass away.
Huh? To pass away? To die.
Simply that. Simply to die. He means simply to die. When he says to pass away.
Yeah, it's just the term to die. Yeah. So he's saying to pass away, to die sitting or standing. I mentioned yesterday. It's a kind of a set phrase, but yeah, there's no metaphysics here. He means die. to be able to have the freedom to die, just like that. To be content to die. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Colin.
There are traditions in Rinzai Zen, Japanese Rinzai Zen today, where they do that. But I don't recommend it because I've seen so many problems that come along with it. I would just naturally give all the energy you have to the breath. That's enough. You don't have to force it. But to take the incredible energy that we have, that's usually just shooting about all over the place, thinking about this, thinking about that, wandering off about that, imagining that, huh? If we just take the energy that we have and give it to the breath, that's enough. We don't have to force anything. There are many other problems that can come about if you try to force it. So I would counter against that from the experience, my own experience, and looking at many others. Okay. There are no more questions about the text. We can get back to the real issues, huh? Whoops, I spoke too soon.
One question: How can we get a copy of that?
There's already a rough draft up on our website, but any day now, I've already sent this manuscript to the webmaster. That's the real master in the UK. And somehow, probably within a few days, maybe even by the time this retreat is ended, it will be on our website. I don't understand it any more than you do, maybe, but there it is. But yeah, it will be up there, okay? Juliana, could you make a copy for Joe, because he doesn't have a computer?
Sure.
when it's up there. Okay. Now there's only the 2-page translation, and it's a rather rough one. I've made some corrections already. It's also in Hungarian, but that's not going to help you. But within the next few days, there should be the entire manuscript, about 22 pages, including my comments on it. Okay, it should be up in a few days. Okay. Joe.
How do you know the truth from the falsity? You know, like yesterday I had a giant paranoid incident, and even though I was sitting, I still had it. It carried outside of the sitting.
Mm-hmm.
And when I came back in, it finally dissipated.
Mm-hmm.
When I went back in, mm-hmm. in the sitting. Now, can it happen either way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that can occur anywhere.
Whether you're sitting or not.
Yeah, I mentioned yesterday the example of maybe getting up from sitting and taking a walk, or even daily life, you see something. Maybe a person's face is a good example, I think, that reminds you of something, a trauma you had or a wonderful experience, and the wheels start turning. Do you know what I mean? Well, that can just happen anywhere, anytime. But also in the depths of our zazen, that's when they tend to talk about, use that term, makyo, these demon states, literally, demonic states. Huh? They can happen in zazen as well. They can happen anytime, anywhere.
Okay. So there's no real...
Maybe the real question is how can you tell whether it's a demonic state or
right.
I'm enlightened?
No, well, I'm paranoid. No, really. I mean,
well, there it is. But you were able to discern that, right?
Yeah, but there was a whole 15-minute period where I firmly believed that what was there was an actuality.
Yeah, yeah.
And if it wasn't for the fact that I only had 10 minutes to think about it, there's a high possibility I would have acted on it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, you know, walking down the street and being shocked, you normally are shocked, so you stand and you go, what was that? But if you're dealing with it and then you go for a walk and it's still all there, I'm sure you can see what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, well, that for me, that was the real value of what I call sitting through, which is close to what they're talking about, maintaining that concentrated state of dhyana, the concentrated, sustained practice of dhyana. Huh? In other words, if you're sitting, even if you're sitting properly, Leah was saying, what do you mean by that? It's a good question. You know? But even if you're sitting properly, maybe because you're sitting properly sometimes, those things, the demons of the past or whatever, they may arise. And we need to be able, practically speaking, to discern, to clearly see, is this real or not? Even if it's not real, it can still be a valuable teaching device to us. We can still learn something about the past and about the present. But to know whether something is real or not, in Zazen, the best way is simply to sit through. To sit through. And then you know. Always be willing to question, to doubt. If it can be doubted, go right ahead. Go right ahead. Zen is not the kind of religion that tries to wipe away doubt or deny it or say it's evil. That's the demon. Doubt is the demon almost in some religious practices. Not at all here. If there is a doubt, pursue it to the end. Sit right through it. And I find that that works very well. That works very well. Because you can learn something from it. You can learn something from it. Sometimes we need to learn something. Experience a long time ago, we think it's gone. But then it comes up again and we realize, you know, I never resolved that. It's still unresolved. I need to say I'm sorry, something as simple as that. Yeah. Not now, but when the retreat's over, I'm going to write a letter. I'm going to go over, and I'm going to see that person, and I'm going to say, I'm sorry. It was 10 years ago, but I need to do that. Or maybe accept an apology from someone that you couldn't before. Do you know what I mean? So sometimes things come up, and you realize It's not real. It's empty. Okay, but it also has something to teach us. And what I've found is if you do that, first of all, by letting the experience come in all its intensity, let it shoot right through you. Huh? You don't have to judge it. You don't have to, you know, remain apart, observing it. No, let it come. Shoot right through you. All the way. See what it has to say. Then you can let it go. It doesn't come back. It doesn't come back. But also you may learn something from it in the process. For example, I need to apologize to that person, or I need to write a letter and say what that person is doing is wrong. Something like that. Do you know what I mean? There may be practical action that is required. And that... actually can come out of the sitting. So as you sit through, the trust grows that the question is there and the solution, it's right there. We don't, you know, there's a tendency to want to get out of that painful situation. But in a word, the way of Zen is not by getting out of it, but by going all the way into it. That's how we really get out of it. Okay. You may also want to speak with someone about it. It may be helpful to do that as well, a Dharma friend or someone who can help you see it in a different perspective. That may be helpful too.
Yeah.
It's not all my answers are solved by sitting in Zazen. That's a big problem. Some issues may need the insight of another person. I find that very helpful myself, sometimes to talk with someone else about it. I remember when I was a little kid, I wrote a little bit about it in my autobiography, being so insecure because my parents, as you know them, divorced when I was young, and it left this tremendous insecurity in me, you know? As I put it, I was so insecure I couldn't even tell someone about it. And of course, now I realize if I could have talked about it, my brother, my sister, my mother, somebody, and said, you know, I'm so insecure sometimes, you know, I don't even know what to do. And maybe they would have said, oh, you know, I feel that way sometimes too. But of course I didn't. That's how insecure I was. So I never said to anyone about it. So of course it just stays there and festers, you know. Remember my 50th birthday party? My twin sister Jean and I came back to Philadelphia for our 50th birthday. I have a twin sister. She's passed away a few years ago, but and we wanted to celebrate it together. One of the opportunities, we went and spent a night in a bed and breakfast and did some really nice, you know, things. 50 years old, you know. She called me her womb-mate, which is not a roommate with a cold, but a womb-mate. Since the womb, we were. Well, when she first said it, I thought she would say, you're my womb-mate. No. You are my womb-mate. Anyway, we went to a bed and breakfast. We had a chance. We had some champagne, and we talked. And I said, remember, Jean, when we were young, 6, 7 years old, so insecure because seeing our parents, you know, they our two gods, mom and dad, they couldn't live together. You know, there's no way a 5, 6-year-old child can understand that. So we end up maybe, you know, maybe if I hadn't have been born, this wouldn't happen. Or, you know, we can't understand what's actually going on in the adult world. So I told my sister about that. You remember how we felt, you know, like so insecure? And her response was, well, I never felt that way. But for 50 years, I assume she felt the same way. Yeah? And if I had opened up to her when I was 6, you see what I mean? So there's value in that too. Yeah. Does that help you? Does anyone else want to speak from out of their experience? Julianne.
Sensei, I just want to share the Chinese understanding of this demon of mind. It's not really a spirit or something we think about. It's more like a challenge, whatever comes. It's almost like an obstacle comes during your sitting. And like a sensei's insecurity, that will cause you some kind of a challenge, a difficulty, and thinking about Mara, testing Buddha, sending all these women, dancing in front of him, these are all the demons we are talking about. So it's not really something spirit bothering me. It's not that sense. And so thinking about Mara, you think about phenomena, then you could understand it with a much easier way. Mm-hmm. I think then you would know how to work with the environment and with your own self and then all those difficulties, instead of thinking it's a spirit bothering you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'm sorry, you said Mara?
Yeah, Mara.
Mara was the demon testing Awakas against Buddha's teaching and didn't believe, you know, whatever he taught. And then he started sending women to try to get Buddha corrupt and then, you know, Buddha touch the earth.
Yeah, if you read the sutras, it's very it's a great psychological insight, but naturally it's put in the language and the folklore, you might say, of 2,500 years ago in India. So it's this kind of a demon god, a demon, Mara, who is trying to prevent Gautama Buddha from getting awakened, because then he will be out of his control. As long as he's a suffering, deluded human being, Mara can always get us, can always tempt us with something. So when Gautama Buddha was about to be awakened, Mara, with his, you know, ESP, you know, these demons, they can be very psychic. They have very good abilities. He said, oh my God, he's going to get it. Uh-oh, I better do something. So the most beautiful women he could imagine, he started sending them to this not very old, maybe 32-year-old man, you know, these really dancing, very voluptuous women, you know. But he stayed, he wasn't tempted by them. And Mara sent all kinds of things, but nothing finally worked. And then Mara kind of challenged him, you know, what is your, I forget how he put it, but how can you be sure that these are not real, huh? Just what Joe is asking. How do you know that this is not real? And then Gautama Buddha, it's interesting how you put it, very Chinese, huh? He touched the ground, and then they say he went like that. But in Buddha's mirror, he touched the ground. This, just referring to the immediate fact. This, ain't no demons here. And then soon
the
after he awakened.
But
that's
witness.
Huh? Yeah, the earth, thank you. The earth is my witness, right. So I don't think it's quite the Philly style, but Mara kind of said, can I get a witness? And then he said, the earth is my witness. Thank you. It's always great to have these Chinese librarian researchers. They go, I don't know how they remember all that stuff. The earth is my witness. That's it. Yeah. But that's very helpful, I think, for Joe, what you were talking about, too. Yeah. Thank you.
And I think that's come back to the text you are teaching, is that the mindfulness, the concentration, discipline, and then wisdom comes. Mm. So all the practice is important.
Tina. Judy?
We do a lot of zazen, we become aware of a state that we're in all the time of projecting onto other people what we're thinking and feeling. So we might, and not being aware that it's a projection.
Yeah.
But when we do a lot of zazen, we become aware that we do project.
Mm-hmm.
So we might think of, you know, somebody looked at me funny. I think that person doesn't like me. That kind of thing. And then you elaborate on it.
Mm-hmm.
But you become aware of that. Mm-hmm. And then you become uncertain. Well, which is it really true this person doesn't like me? Or, you know, and so on. So you do have to be careful about acting on that
mm-hmm.
kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And also you conceive things about another person. That person is not, it's not really a good person
mm-hmm.
for no reason, or you have some reason. Something about the person triggers this
mm-hmm.
in you,
yeah.
And you begin to elaborate a whole other person there,
yes.
other than the real person.
Yeah.
And then you wonder,
mm-hmm.
wait a minute, what's real here?
Mm-hmm.
I think with the awareness that you develop in Zazen, you can check yourself.
Mm.
You can, you know, you for a while you might not, you might be in that delusion about the other person,
mm.
and then you check and see, oh no, that person's not even thinking of me. Is not even aware of me on the one hand, or I'm projecting all kinds of things onto this person. There's absolutely no evidence
mm-hmm.
of these things. So, but I think that it's something that we do in our life, maybe just constantly,
mm-hmm.
making up the world as we go along,
mm-hmm.
making up the other people as we go along.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Zazen, when it faces us with it, gives us another view.
Mm. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, for me, Zazen helps me to encounter the other as who they are,
mm-hmm.
whoever they are, not what, as you're saying, projection. Yeah, the whole idea of a projection is you're not, if you're aware of it, it wouldn't be a projection. It couldn't work. But it's because you're not at least fully aware of it, right? That it makes it possible. But if you can just encounter the person rather than your conception, expectation, memory from something else, yeah. It's a practice. Yeah. David.
Yeah, the thought that comes to mind, for me, in science at least, is the idea of a very clear lake.
Hmm.
You drop a stone in that lake. Whenever the stone is dropped, there's this confluence that touches.
Hmm.
Many stones are dropped. And I think Zazen for me is to see all that.
Hmm.
To experience all the ripple effects.
Hmm.
And it's not just the thought of you being the ripple, but you're experiencing all those other pieces. And there is constructive, destructive parts. Something will escalate, some things will cancel out.
Mm.
And it's a beautiful analogy for me to see that there is this interconnectedness that goes on. And that sitting, experiencing that, it's not trying to remove that, it's to actually experience. I think we often want everything to be still.
Yeah.
There's nothing there.
Yeah.
No, that's the part where you're experiencing the totality, I guess the totality of what's there.
Mm.
There's no separateness.
Mm. Yeah, and it doesn't end up just being a dead blankness. Thank you. Tina.
Just wanted to say, I appreciated what you said. You know, I have struggled, I think, over the years. I'm a therapist, you know, the psychology of spirituality. I think maybe that's what it is. And always these little things, you know, delusions, let go. You know, to me now, when I learned early, delusions were something that people who were, you know, could be pretty impaired
mm-hmm.
would have a delusion.
Yeah.
But I think in Western psychology, mm-hmm. you know, we use the term paranoid all the time, and it has a different meaning. I'm in my own practice trying to sort out how to integrate my spirituality and psychology, and it has been a struggle for me. So I'm glad that you brought that up, because, you know, we're sitting here, it's a spiritual struggle, but we use psychological words. It's
mm-hmm.
a funny thing.
Mm-hmm.
Western-wise, and I was struck by what Juliana said, because, you know, the Chinese and the culture, and, you know, she really knows Buddhism,
mm.
you know, from the sutras.
Mm.
But it's sort of saying the same thing.
Mm.
I mean, that's what strikes me. So it's similar in the meaning of it. So thank you for helping me clarify my confusion about that.
You know, just as we need to be wary about taking the Indian or the Chinese imagery and assuming that we know what it means, it may not, a dragon, for example, is a very different creature in Europe than it is in the Far East. But at the same time, maybe part of your point is the tendency naturally is to take Western psychology and say, well, what, the demons, this is a psychological phenomena, you know. Yeah, there's, that's helpful, but it probably isn't going to perfectly connect up. So we need to be careful about that too. Do you know what I mean? Psychologizing, it can be helpful. We need some kind of language if we're going to talk accurately about it and not just fuddle on about these mystical images that nobody really understands, and that doesn't help anybody, you know. So
I was raised as a Catholic. I mean, I know all about the devil. So it's kind of like I am not familiar with the devil, you know. But that's again Western Catholic mythology, you know. It's the same thing, though, you know. Do you remember Flip Wilson,
yes,
the devil made me buy this dress? Oh, Flip Wilson. I always thought that was pretty funny. I'm a comedian, but you know, there's a thing. So it's, you know, so the devil made you do it, Joe?
Yes.
Got it. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
Gerald?
They're close, different cultures.
Yes,
but
exactly.
They're drinking buddies anyway. Huh?
The devil would try to, you know, entice Christ.
Yes.
If he could.
Yes, and make him feel bad.
Well, make him lose his pet.
Yes.
The devil would try to entice Christ. Also, when these things come up, though, too, you spoke about when important things come up in Zazen, long hidden. Important issues. It's also very important, I think, to realize that a lot of this is utterly meaningless. But a lot of these things, maybe there's an energy blockage. Some of my friends would say maybe there's a psychological help, like surfacing, whatever. It's also very important to realize when these things are meaningless and just let them go and ignore them and say, I had an insane thought.
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe part of Joe's question is, how do you discern that?
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying. This is the important point, because I know people who will think, oh, this came up. You know, what does it mean?
Mm-hmm.
What is the significance for my life?
Mm-hmm.
And this is something you need to kind of walk away from.
Mm-hmm.
Know when something is about significance.
Yeah.
See, I don't necessarily agree with you, Gerald. I think that there is a little working through. It doesn't come up for nothing. That's my take.
But it sometimes it does. It's important to know when it does.
We disagree.
Well, you know, if you use an example, it may help. If you're thinking about what we had for dinner, we had Mexican last night. There were two Mexicans in the audience. Isn't that great? Did the Mexicans enjoy the dinner? Well, this is not really, we don't really need to spend 10 minutes on that.
No, I'm speaking of people who...
But I'm trying to give an example of that's just something that you're, as you're saying, that can just be let go.
Well, if I'm thinking of things like when people, if you, you know, go to Zazen, some people will spontaneously start crying or something like this will happen.
Oh,
and they'll say, you know, I don't know why that happened. And the...
You're talking with psychologists in the audience here, better. And it was nothing.
Yeah, and it was...
You just leave it.
Told you have to be able to discern, oh, there's something... be dealt with. And no, it was just nothing. It was some complex the mind or some blocked energy that surfaced because I took off the pressure or because I...
So the point is you don't want the person to obsess about it and, you know,
yes.
I have to, you know.
Yes.
But Tina's maybe saying, yeah, but often there may be something
sometimes
there.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You have to be very careful about the situation.
Yeah.
I don't always think that...
So you're not really disagreeing, huh?
I'm afraid
we're not disagreeing, Carol.
You can fight it out after lunch. Marty.
There's one line that might go to this. A brief reference to seeing your thought or noting your thought.
Mm-hmm. Being aware of it.
And then it will disappear.
Disappear.
If you could talk a little bit about that process, that might, might help.
Yeah, in Europe, when I went through this, you know, one person said, you know, I'm aware of it, but it doesn't disappear, you know. what the text is saying is, if you are aware of it, Leon, properly, you in if you're sitting properly, and it's not that there's never going to be a thought or some kind of an emotional thing might come up. No, it does come up. What do you then do? It says very simply, be aware of it. You have to pretend it's not there. No, you let it be what it is. You be aware of it. And once you are aware of it, it will disappear. This is the essence of it. Is that simple? Well, ideally, it is that simple. But the point is, we usually don't do that. What we usually do is we become aware of it, and then we let it take us for a ride, or we take it for a ride, or we compare it with some other thought. And that's not what it, what it's saying is, you become aware of it, you realize it, let it be what it is. If you really let it be what it is, then it does disappear, because it cannot contain, it cannot sustain itself. It's only because you're thinking it that it exists in the first place. It's not existing out there in the world. So by feeding it, it will continue. And then you can have just someone spending their whole lifetime analyzing some little event in their life, for example, which is probably not that helpful. Although there may be something there. But in Zazen, this isn't psychodrama, in the religious practice, the Buddhist practice of Zazen, you simply allow it to arise. You don't analyze it. There is a time and a place for that, but not in Zazen. You don't judge it. I shouldn't have that thought. You don't need that either. You don't even need to do that. You don't need to compare it either. When you look at the text carefully, it's, you don't need to do anything with it. That's the hard part. Because we want to do so much with it. We want to manipulate, right? But it's saying, be aware of it. Simply be aware of it. I would say, let it be what it is. And if you can really just let it be what it is, you maybe learn from it, but you also let it go. And it doesn't come back. That's why it says, eventually the conditions come to rest and all is unified. It's speaking about that fact. That is what happens. Does that help, Marty?
Yeah. I think, you know, if you're really attentive, caring, however you'd like to talk about it, it's as you say, you're not really two things. Mm-hmm. You're one being. And if you're very attentive to something and give your whole heart to it, then you're that. Mm-hmm. And whatever that was breaks up into the attentiveness. Mm-hmm. And so you're made whole again. Mm-hmm. Just through your attentiveness. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You've been sitting for a long time. Would you like to stand up and stretch for a moment? No, never mind. Okay. Do you have a question? If you would like to stand up and stretch, we're going to do a little Japanese here, so it's not going to affect you one way or the other. Hi. いわば妄想が出てくるんですね。妄想が出てくるとどうするか、どう対応するか、無視するか、対応するか、どうすればいいかね。そしてやっぱりそれはその妄想によって違うから、ある意味ではこの間言ったように妄想は妄想です。いい妄想、素晴らしい妄想。当たった妄想でも妄想です。末期です、ね。本物じゃない。しかし、例えば座るときに何かの古い思い出が出てくるとね、何回も出てくる。
出てくる。妄想の止め方の話でしたか、
うんうん、そうそうそう。そうそうそう。okay、何か。
それのディスカッション。
うん、そうそうそう。何か。一言があればおっしゃってくださいよ。
いや、それはもちろん自分の今の随測かなる随
そうね、それも言いますわね、皆さんが集まってね、いますね。 具体的なあれでね、助かると思います。それしかないでしょう。それが見ないでしょう。ありがとうございます。 When everybody gets back, I'll say what Tatsuda-san was mentioning. So you're really trying to poison me with this, aren't you?
No, it's only the second cup.
That's
one
of my paranoid
thoughts. I tried once, it didn't work.
Right. What do you think?
Sit.
We were supposed to end 2 minutes ago?
Seven minutes ago.
So what do we do?
We can... We can continue the discussion.
We still have two more, not three, but two more. It says three on the sheet, but it's actually two 40-minute sits. So that's going to end up being one a little bit maybe.
Yeah.
Huh? But that should be enough. At least if I can get through one-on-one with everyone.
Yeah.
Huh? But we only have, four more people left. Huh? So it should be no problem. So maybe we should give a few more minutes just to see if there's anything else that needs to come out.
Were there something about the hindrances that you wanted to
say? Yeah, that's what I was trying to get to, but we got hindered here. Yeah.
Do you want to go into that?
Yeah, I think, I thought that's where we were heading. But
yeah.
I mean, in a way, we were there. So Tatsuda-san was having trouble understanding, as you can imagine, our discussion. Native speakers would probably have difficulty understanding. So I briefly explained what we were talking about. And she was saying, yeah, in the traditional Zen, Rinzai Zen practice, if something comes up, basically, it's taken as a kind of a delusion. Anything that may come up is taken as a delusion, and then we simply sit, or if we're doing koan practice, we rouse the koan. And we focus on the koan, if that's what we're doing. Or if we're doing the breath, we simply focus on the breath rather than going with the delusion, as it would tend to be called probably in Japanese Zen, which is already so culturally laden, right, that they would call it a delusion. Here we would probably tend to psychologize it and not give it, we would give it a more politically correct term anyway, right? Is there one?
Because delusion?
Yeah, because you were, one of your points was helpful to me was the idea of a psychological delusion, that's pretty serious stuff. But in, but I never thought of that before. In the general Buddhist jargon in English, we're using it all the time for everything, delusion. So that can be very confusing. Because in Western psychology.
That is coming, that is not, well, see, Joe really, I mean, you put it beautifully. It's something that is not real. But it's not clear that it's not real. It's got a really negative feeling. This doesn't feel really good. And is this real or not real? And I like what Julia said. You know, if you put your hand to the ground, what's realistic? Is this really realistic?
Yeah, but
yeah.
I think the illusion in America is that this distortion of the person's reality that he believes, what is arising was originally caused by something. Otherwise, it wouldn't come up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or you would, see, the hard thing, and I guess I'll just use the term, for example, somebody in America who is schizophrenic,
mm-hmm.
you know, a person who has maybe brain chemistry problems,
mm-hmm.
or, I mean, there are things that are the matter with them, that fundamentally, people like that, they need to be on medication, but their reality is not in line with the general public in a way.
Mm.
We used to talk about beliefs that are not confirmed by cultural norms,
yeah.
or...
Which is not necessarily reality, but...
right. I mean, it gets really... I mean, you know, what I liked about Gogu, language is inadequate in the end to describe things. I mean, in the end, we... because we have different languages. But Joe speaks American.
Right.
Joe speaks our language. I mean,
if you look at the Zen literature and you and you're American and your introduction to it is God walks up to the Zen master and goes, "Master, I'm suffering, what do I do?"
Well, that's not
you're,
very good.
You're an American.
But you see, I think...
And what's an American going to do? He's going to turn around and whack you right back.
Well,
he's not going to get anything.
Well, it's true. Although you
it's
see,
the interpretation.
Let's return to the intellectual delusions.
Well,
okay?
One of the things, though, about Jeff, and I will show you, know, I've known Jeff for, I think, probably... I didn't know you before the monastery, but I knew you probably shortly after the monastery, and probably shortly after you. And I remembered somebody saying that you worked at Friends Hospital. You know, I sort of tried to put two and two together. That you knew something about American psychology. And I always thought that you were a very good bridge because you became very good at being a Japanese, you know, culturally, understanding that culture. But you never left this culture.
Mm.
If you're bicultural in a way, I think. And I think that's been the nice bridge because, you know, he knows both cultures.
Mm.
And he can explain Japanese Rinzai Zen to our culture. So he is a Zen master, but he wouldn't slap you.
Speak for yourself, Dina. Speak for yourself. A time and a place for everything, huh?
Well, I think that's part of it.
Yeah. Well, let's return to what Marty raised.
Okay.
It came up yesterday, and it seemed to really evoke a strong response from many people, the notion that there are not just conscious delusions. I have to use that word more carefully. But generically, unconscious delusions or more fundamental attachments, views that are so deeply in us that we are not aware of them. It's not something we consciously do. It's something almost prior to that. There's a very little known capping phrase that I mentioned a few years ago, and I'll mention it again because it's extraordinary. It's very difficult to translate, but something like intellectual delusions break off suddenly like the Vajra diamond. When you've seen through something, when that discursive thought, it's gone. It's gone. It's like that. It happens at once. The second line, emotional delusions.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the more deeply ingrained, unconscious, we might say. Huh? Emotional delusions are gradually severed like lotus threads. It literally says the threads of the lotus root. It's a very tangly, gnarled thing, and you don't just like that. You have to it takes some work. It's a tangled thread. Usually Zen doesn't go there, doesn't even make that distinction. But this is one capping phrase where it actually makes this distinction, and maybe a little too neatly, but it's very precious in our practice, I think. What happens when discursive thought disappears? It disappears. It may return, but at that moment it's gone. It's gone. The vista, the walls are gone. The walls are down. There's no doubt about it. Boom. But that, again, it's a difficult word to translate. Emotional, or the attitudes, the underlying attitudes, that stuff doesn't just, oh, like that. It can take work. It can take work. And this is one very extraordinary capping phrase in the Zen tradition that actually acknowledges that. The question is, where do we go with that? How do we work with that? That's what I've been working on. You have something to say to that, Marty? So once again, you can see, once the Zazen has started to take effect, once that concentrated samadhi is there, the whole whirlwind of our intellectual thoughts, that constant chatter, it just dissolves. It's gone. It may come back, but it is gone. But with these inveterate tendencies, how to describe it? The tendencies are emotional attachments, our more basic attitudes that can get triggered by almost anything. That takes real work. So even though you may have a decisive, definitive breakthrough, a real realization of no self, that's why I'm always insisting that's where the practice begins. The problem is, in the ecstasy of that experience, it seems like, what do you mean? There is nothing more to do. How could there be anything more to do? There is. Wait 10 minutes or 10 days, or meet your mother-in-law or whatever. There are different ways to test that. But you know, if you don't think there's anything more to do, keep your eye open. That's what this capping phrase is getting at. And it's almost challenging us. That's right. It's not just like that. It's like this tangled gnarl of the lotus root that you've really got to hack away. Unless you're willing to do that work as well as half the exit, you shouldn't be in the Zen school, perhaps. You shouldn't be in the Zen gate. I would say that work is at least as important as the initial breakthrough. Otherwise, the breakthrough can become a breakdown.
Specifically Zen way of doing that work, as opposed to, say, in psychoanalysis, you see, but then you have to work through, otherwise it makes no difference in your life. Mm. Is there a specific way?
Well, it's certainly not a systematic way that we would hope in the West. But, for example, if you look at the koan practice, there are many different kinds of koans. There are initial koans to have a genuine breakthrough, but that's the beginning. After that, there are literally hundreds and hundreds of other koans. And if you look carefully at them, you can see what they're doing. They're constantly hacking away from every different angle to make sure that there's nothing left, and then that nothing left can come to life and express itself in language, in silence, in whatever way is needed to be of service to others. But it's not at all a systematic thing like we would probably do in the West. We would make up a course description and we would have, you know, outline and everything like that. Zen doesn't work that way, for better or for worse. But the idea is, by the practice, if it is thoroughgoing, this stuff will get worked out. Maybe we need some guidance, but that's what's going on. Huh? And those koans can be very helpful there. Huh? But frankly, I would say at least as important as that is the actual encounter with the other person. If you're doing the practice with a genuine teacher, like when I trained with Fukushima Roshi, I could do the koans, which was great, but also I could see him in his life, which in a way was even more important. Do you see what I mean? Because I could see him not trying to put it into the formula of the koans. He was just living it. I had the great good fortune to come here for 4 years as his kind of assistant interpreter, translator. 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks, long time we did it, 9 weeks, coming here and going all over the country, meeting Janet and other people. You know, all of a sudden, I was with that guy for 15 seconds a couple times a day in the Doksan room, where there's no room for that stuff to be brought up. I'm having a bit of a problem. I wonder if there's no room for that. There's just the koan. I won't say that stuff doesn't get resolved in going through it, but you don't say, you know, in Soto Zen you can, but not in Rinzai Zen. You know, I'm feeling a little depressed today, Master. You might get hit. You might get hit. Because there's only the koan. There's only the koan. But I would still say, working through that with a real teacher, it's coming out of his life, and you can see that. If you have a fake teacher, a teacher who still has real problems to work through and is using that to further his own ends, as sometimes happens, you know, well, it would be better not to practice than to practice in such a situation. That's a real poison. That's a real poison. But it is not in any way systematized. But still, I would insist it's there if you have an authentic guide who never, you know, he never taught that to me. He never showed, I'm going to do a little psychology with you today, Jeff. Never, not once. And yet, I learned an enormous amount by being with him, sometimes asking questions, sometimes him getting angry or being happy, whatever it was. I'm afraid that's about the best I can do. But. Okay.
Now it sounds like the way Kong Su's disciples learn from him, partly by asking questions, but partly he did it this way.
Does anyone want to say anything? Yes.
I think this is one of the unfortunate aspects of Zen history that with what's been called the rhetoric of immediacy, the emphasis on the sudden enlightenment, that this whole gradual side of the tradition became taboo.
Yeah.
And that's one of Bielefeld's points. This manual was the first manual. It was written for centuries because you weren't supposed to talk about practice.
Right.
And a lot got lost.
Yeah.
And viewing the tradition from the outside, if you don't have the lived experience of life, and you're just reading the books, or maybe a not so good teacher, it gets lost.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But it was there. As you're saying, this is interesting what you're saying about the koan system, how it's still there under wraps, so to speak, in the koan system.
I mean, also the point that you mentioned yesterday of that dhyana power, it's really what I would say is that attentiveness again. And it's just being able to apply that in a kind of a rigorous way to something that's very ingrained and difficult, but it's not different in quality. It's still that attentiveness, I think.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of using that word, attentiveness, huh? It's a kind of a non-discursive focus, huh? Attentiveness, huh? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are we ready to get back to Zazen? Looks like it. Well, this may have looked like a rather all over the place lecture discussion, and in a way it was, but I think we hit on a lot of valuable nuggets, gems, facets that need to be opened up and looked at. We need to keep our eye open as we do this practice and not just think if I have this one experience, all my problems, maybe not yours, but all my problems will be solved. That's a very big problem. And so we return humbly and patiently to the practice. Thank you all for your questions, your answers, your input. We are, do you see? We really are doing this together. It's not something you receive from someone else. Doesn't work that way. The real thing doesn't work that way. Thank you again.